As we all make another orbit of the sun, it's interesting to think that we actually live in this ocean of waves. From the motion of planets that give us our years, months, and days, to our biological clocks of sleep, breath, and heartbeats, and up into that ocean of electromagnetic radiation that's just getting deeper and deeper, of 4G, 5G, and then up to the visible spectrum, which gives us a window to the world. And right in the middle of it, we are gifted from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, more or less, this canvas for sound and music. All you need to know for this lecture is that low frequency means a long wavelength. So you can imagine a string. It's very long and it vibrates very slowly, and that produces a low pitch. Conversely, a very short string, like when you're fretting high on a guitar, creates a high frequency and therefore a high pitch. So let's see where our audience's windows lie. What I'm going to do is give a sweep from 20 hertz, which you won't hear, up to 20 kilohertz. Not too loud, but... And what I'd like you to do is just raise your hand when you can hear a tone, not just noise, but a clear tone, and then drop it as soon as it disappears. Be honest. Ready? Here we go.
The Gresham College lecture that you're listening to right now is giving you knowledge and insight from one of the world's leading academic experts. Making it takes a lot of time, but because we want to encourage a love of learning, we think it's well worth it. We never make you pay for lectures, although donations are needed. All we ask in return is this: send a link to this lecture to someone you think would benefit, and if you haven't already, click the follow or subscribe button from wherever you're listening right now. Now, let's get back to the lecture.
I hope you're raising your hands now. Thank you for taking part in the Gresham College Age Survey. That saves us a lot of time. So that window, whatever it is for all of you, is the canvas on which music is painted. And musicians use all of it. This is the end orchestral chord of A Day in the Life, the Beatles. And John Lennon requested a 15 kilohertz tone. I've squared it in red here. Reportedly to annoy the dog. It actually, at 15 kilohertz, it also annoys cats, cows, guinea pigs, bats, and anyone under the age of 18. So what I'm going to do is play it for you. You'll hear the orchestral noise, and then we'll play that tone. And then I've transposed it down, so eventually everyone can hear it. I've basically scaled it down. Again, let's raise hands if we can hear it. Not just the tape hiss, but it should be a pure tone. What? Sickening, isn't it? There it is. So below that is our audible spectrum, where we find all our music. And I'm just going to take you on a brief tour of it. We start in the high region from the top of the female vocals. So we'll hear the squeal of Mary Clayton, which we heard in lecture one, down to the top F6 of Queen of the Night. Ooh. Now to the mid-high region of flutes, bassoons, and pianos. And right in the middle. Now let's move to the region of cellos, the bottom of male vocals, and then the lowest note an orchestra can play.
I that binds, because you're mine.
Ooh.
I walk the line, because you're mine. I walk the line.
You don't get the melody yet. What we have to remember that this audible spectrum doesn't come with notes attached and grid lines. It's just this gradient. And the history of music shows that no one can decide what any of the notes are. This is a brief history of where concert A is over time. I've labeled a few of them here. Clearly, 1759 Trinity College was the birth of dubstep. And still now, although A440 is prevalent, we still find different standards, but an orchestra is slightly higher. Orchestras in Cuba apparently tune lower to save on strings because they're hard to come by. And there's something else called the internet, which has decided that 432 hertz is the one true frequency and everything else is a form of mind control. Nevertheless, we're not really so interested in naming a particular frequency, but in how these frequencies fit together, what makes them in tune. And for that, we turn to this mythical figure of Pythagoras. Here he is on what looks like an early Instagram account, having a fun day. And what you'll see is he's playing various instruments with these numbers attached to them. And instruments is the right word because they are both musical instruments and scientific instruments to find about music and to find out about science at the same time. And he was fascinated by the concept that number connects to music, which is actually quite profound. For example, if we play halfway along the string, doubling its frequency, we get an octave, which sounds completely harmonious, almost equivalent to the note, which didn't have to be necessarily. And he felt this was the case because there was an order to the entire cosmos that governed the music of the, that governed the motion of the planets and our inner lives, and also music, a universal music, a music of the spheres. You can see it depicted here, and these are orbiting planets actually spelling out notes along a monochord. So it is, in fact, true. There is this deep connection between number and tuning. If you think of it this way, if we take a string, we can divide it up into even parts. And what happens when we get that is a fascinating series of intervals. This is known as the harmonic series, and it's showing equal divisions of a string. You'll see those nodal points, and you can eke them out of any instrument, actually, but a guitar is easy to represent. You see where those nodes occur, that's where they appear on the string. If you touch lightly, strangely, they go higher as you go lower, but there are many, many of them, and it's mirrored as well in a really beautiful fashion. So let's just take a brief tour of some of the lower end of this harmonic series. So the first thing we find between harmonic 1 and 2 is an interval known as an octave. And the octave, say, from low C to a C, is so universal, nearly universal, I'll say, that almost every music culture has the same note name for notes that are separated by an octave. They just keep repeating. They didn't have to do that, but it shows that there is some sort of equivalence that exists there. And so that means when we double a frequency or halve a string, we will always go up an octave. So the second harmonic gives us an octave. Where would the next harmonic be? The next octave would be on 4th, 8th, and the 16th. So these octaves go on forever. Let's move to the next harmonic, which is the third harmonic. That gives us an octave and a fifth. And the fifth, again, is a near universal building block of music. We heard it in lecture one many times over. Which means if we triple a frequency, we get an octave and a fifth. So the third harmonic, and then the ninth is an octave and a fifth above that. But here's a nice little trick we can do. Between the third and the second harmonic, because the second harmonic is an octave, the third is an octave and a fifth, is a gap of a fifth. So that ratio, 3 against 2, gives us what we'll call a pure fifth, meaning it's sourced from the harmonic series. Going to the next prime number, we get this fifth harmonic, which gives us 2 octaves and this sweet, sweet major third. And again, we can use this trick. 5 against 4 gives us a major third. And we'll call that a pure third. So that's all you need to know for this lecture, really, is these three. What we're presented with, what the cosmos sings to us, is a major triad almost immediately. And we can generate it really easily. We can tell a computer to play 100 hertz, 200 hertz, 300 hertz, and so on. And we get these sounds. You'll note some sound a bit strange. The ones that sound strange are the prime ones, 7, 11, and 13. So these will keep continuing. We know that because of a force known as mathematics. But these are sort of the ingredients of tuning. But what's fascinating is that harmonics emerge naturally on almost every instrument, most stunningly in overtone singing, where a single singer sings a fundamental and then somehow ekes out harmonics so clearly that it sounds like whistling. So this is an incredible overtone singer now performing for you harmonics 4 through to 16. Listen out for 11 and 7. Music naturally emerges from this harmonic series. Here's the first 5 with some orchestral accompaniment. Above that first triad, we get something that sounds like soul, essentially. Again, this is a single singer. Inflections are incredible. Here's the seventh coming up. Notice at the bottom there's these numbers sent. What this describes is how these harmonics differ from equal temperament. That's what you'd find on a piano. So you'll notice when the numbers are big, like that seventh there, it's minus 31, it might be unfamiliar to you. So we'll call the intervals sourced from the harmonic series pure and the other ones equal tempered. And what's interesting about these pure intervals is they fit perfectly well together. They lock in. So what I'm going to play you is an equal tempered major triad, perfectly valid one that you'd find on the piano, and then tweak it so it fits with the harmonic series. And what you'll see and hear, hopefully, is the choppy waters of a major triad will go into this slow dance, melting into each other. Quite astonishing. And so this is a good place to start if we're going to start making things in tune and building melodies and scales and so on. And in fact, a Pythagorean approach is to take a piece of string and then simply divide it into even parts. Let's say you take you divide it into ninths and you play 8/9 of it and you'll get a harmonious tone. So you can construct these by making equal divisions of a string. And this was an approach used in ancient Greece. These are ancient Greek tetrachords, where you have a perfect fourth, and you simply divide it into even parts. There were various types, genera of them. The diatonic at the bottom, the chromatic, and the very juicy enharmonic at the top. So what I'll do is animate this antique illustration so that we can hear them in place. And what's beautiful is that those two tetrachords could build a number of scales by stacking one on top of the other, making 8 notes the octave. That was the diatonic, the chromatic now, and the juicy one. Oh, sounds so ancient. It's like going back in the mists of time. So that's one approach. Take a string and just divide it up. But we can be more thorough and comprehensive and systematic. For example, we can just use the third harmonic, and just which we'll call the pure fifth, and keep going up and up and up. It'll get us high, but we can just use the law of octave equivalence to drag it down into the scale position. So we get 3s and 9s and 27s, and we just bring them down octaves and gather them up. And these are the sort of bright notes from this upward trajectory of the fifth. But we can do the same backwards. Take the top octave, drop fifths, and then gather them up. So what you have is a strata of major, bright, warm colors, and then some cold ones underneath. So here are the warm ones. Colder ones. And a scale between the two. This brings us to perhaps the most beautiful example of harmonic tuning, and that happens in Indian classical, North Indian classical music, Hindustani, as well as other forms, but we'll focus on this one, which are 22 divisions of the octave. And I'll show you how they're built. So imagine we start with one note, and we'll do the same trick. We go up fifths and down fifths to gather this palette of notes. But this is what's called a five-limit system, which means that we don't just use the third harmonic, but we go up to the fifth to get that sweet major sound into the ingredient. So for any one of these, we can go along the sweet third pathway, up or down, and create an array of these notes. These notes, I'm hearing a strange tone there. Thank you. This is a beautiful array of notes that we can organize. And what we get is this beautiful pattern where the root is fixed, the fifth is fixed, and then for every other chromatic note, there are two flavors, one slightly sharper than the other, always the same distance. It's called the Didymaean comma between the two of them. Now these, you can find on the guitar here, but none of them fit exactly on the fret. They all fall either side of them. They're two flavors of one note. Only the octaves are in. If I put it on a circle, you can see them here, the root and the fifth fixed, and then the two intervals separated by this little comma. Let's hear them. Now, more than just a set of scale tones, these are really emotional resonances, so much so that they're often given names to depict their emotional range. And you'll see that the upper ones are more active than the lower ones. And we have sort of strong and confident and anxious and weak underneath it. And so we can build ragas by selecting from these. So, for example, this beautiful raga takes this selection, and it's an early morning raga. We know it's an early morning raga because it has both moonlight and sunlight in it. And it represents what's called viraha, which is this pain of being in love but not with the person that you love. This achingly beautiful emotion where you're warmed by the love but you're pained by the separation. And so we hear uncertainty and at peace and so on. So I'm going to play you a two-minute extract of this wonderful singer performing just the beginning part of this raga. And I've illustrated where they lie on this diagram here. Just to let you know, whenever she sings at peace, that note, I will be getting a chill over there. But they're wonderful. You'll also hear moonlight before you hear sunlight as the dawn breaks. So you could see why tuning to the harmonic series is so irresistible. And although we live in a 12-tone universe, there have been, through the ages, a small but hugely dedicated series of musicians exploring this world from the fifth harmonic and way above it. The early electronic composers weren't gifted with software and keyboards that lined up with some equal tempered system. They had the obligation and opportunity to dial in tones wherever they could be. And so a lot of them reached back to the ancient past to build scales, or in the case of Wendy Carlos, invent new ones. The writings of prolific British musicologist Kathleen Schlesinger on the Greek aulos, the Greek flute, where she documented from illustrations all the whole positions and conjectured about the tuning systems there. This inspired composers like Harry Partch, who He didn't go up to the fifth harmonic or the seventh, but the 11th. It's a four more dimensional lattice that I can talk about later, but built 43 notes. Of course, no normal instrument can play 43 notes, so he built these extraordinary ones. This is just a fraction of them. You see that adapted guitar? And what's beautiful is he color-coded the harmonics like I did here. You'll see the 11th harmonic is purple, and the fifth harmonic is yellow. One of Schlesinger's friends and students was Elsie Hamilton, an Australian composer, truly dedicated to this world. And she used to build scales from way up there, from the 16th harmonic that she named after planets. So what I'll play you is her study on the Saturn scale from the 16th harmonic, performed by the talented classical guitarist Bridget Mermakidis, no relation. And what I will tell you before we start is that these higher harmonics are an acquired taste. Like anchovies, your first taste might not be the best one. And it's very divisive. Some people won't tell the difference between an out-of-tune guitar and a high-level just intonation. But if you sit with it, you'll hear a real beauty, I hope, particularly in the lower overringing resonances. But back to Earth, in the realm of making 12 notes. See, the issue with just intonation is that it's really beautiful, but it's based around one note. You heard in the Hindustani example, there was a drone and these notes resonated from it. The issue with that is that you can build as many as you like, but the view from one of these other notes is different from that one. If you wanted the same view, you'd have to build a whole orbiting planets around that one, and then further and further. It's boundless. And some music really thrives on a closed system. And we know such a closed system known as the circle of fifths. So we go up fifths, and we go back to where we started. We're happy, and we can make music forever. So let's see what happens if we do that with a pure fifth. 3/2. We go round, and let's hear it. Out of tune. It should be this. But the top note is more like this. And we want to tweak it down to this. This is known as a Pythagorean comma. And what it creates is not a circle of fifths, but a spiral of fifths that never closes. Whoops. It's the difference between 12 pure fifths and 7 octaves. It's a maths problem. And it's about a quarter of a semitone too high. It seems unfortunate, but it's in fact inevitable. When we try and pair up prime numbers, this just is the nature of them. I'll explain it this way. Imagine a chromatic circle, C, C sharp, D, all the way back again. If we take a fifth up, we get to G here, and it's even temperedly marked. A D, you can see, is slightly sharp. And as we complete it to create a 12-point star, there's this gap at the top. So the fifth doesn't agree with the octave. It gets worse. The sweet major third is way short to complete an octave also. And the third and the fifth don't agree with each other either. These are known as commas from the ancient Greek to chop off. They're like the February 29th of tuning. Yeah. And so we have to sort of fudge the system if we're going to close it. So any tuning system with 12 notes is somehow have to has to somehow engage with these commas. Compromise. For example, if in Pythagorean tuning we might favor pure fifths, which means we could have a whole string of fifths around the circle, but because they're slightly too sharp, one of them will be a wolf fifth, a little too narrow. Uh-oh. What if we want pure thirds? Well, you see those yellow lines are creating pure thirds, so we get lovely creations like this. To achieve that, we need slightly narrow fifths, which leaves one crazy wide wolf fifth. So you could play something like this in C major, but in D flat, it sounds very different. So it matters what key you play something in. Here's some Mozart in C major. And in D flat. There's no need to be angry about this. That's my one joke I'm allowed. What we have to do is temper those tunings so they fit together. And that's the history of a large portion of Western music, is deciding how to balance, how to fudge that system. So the velotti system is known as sixth comma. We know what a comma is. It's that extra tuning stuff at the top. So if we divide it in six, we can make six of those fifths a little bit narrow, and we've closed the circle. Why choose these ones here? Because they will give us sweeter thirds in the more common system. But there are other ways to do it, like Werkmeister is a quarter comma system and spreads it out that way. And the one that's most known, and maybe only that it is for some people, is equal temperament, which is the 12th comma system, where every fifth is narrowed just by a little bit. And what that means is that the fifths are almost pure, but none of the thirds are. They're way off. But what that allows is us to modulate and play chords together and transpose to any key. And that's useful, particularly if you want to write something like this. Bach's well-tempered clavier are 24 pieces in every major and minor key. Now, I note it's his well-tempered clavier, not his equal-tempered clavier. So he used a temperament which was adjusted to make each key sound slightly different, to have a character about it. There's him with one of his puzzle canons, which he adored puzzles. We did not know for about 250 years what temperament he used. There were many prevailing at the time, so we're not sure exactly how he would have written this. But a researcher in 2005 came forward with this intriguing conjecture. And that is, if you look at the top of his written autograph manuscript, you see that next to the C of clavier is another C. What the hell's that doing there? And it connects us to the spiral, which just looks decorative. But if you look a little closer and turn it the way it appears to have been written on the bottom of the page, not to smudge it, we get this sequence of loops. But they're not the same. Some have little knots in them, and some are open or pure. And there's just enough of them for us to wrap it around and create a circle of fifths with C marked. And you'll see those open, pure turns are pure fifths, and the knots show the number of fractions of a comma that exist. So we might have a clue of what he heard as he played. Let's compare the two. It's subtle, but you will hear it, I hope. So I'll play you in equal temperament a C major and then this swirl tuning. Fraction. Seats a little bit more. Which means that every key sounded different. So he wasn't just writing in those keys, he was writing for those keys. So I'm going to play a fraction of Prelude number 3 in equal temperament, followed by the swirl tuning. You hear the difference in resonance, maybe? In this case, it becomes more jangly with a swirl tuning. And so we might imagine Bach enjoying the sweeter sonorities of C major, which is the only prelude where he lets notes really ring together. I must say that some scholars disagree with this interpretation of Lehmann's temperament, but I personally find it really compelling, knowing Bach's love of puzzles, and it just seems so particular in that C that's there. And it's just delicious, the idea that the solution was hidden in plain sight for over 250 years, waiting to be discovered for you to see it. See, 12 tones per octave is so established now that we kind of think that's what it is. It's anything else is the stuff of global music or historical practice. So it's quite surprising when you look at what these exemplars of classical music thought about that situation. This is Mozart's lesson notes to the English composer Thomas Attwood. Imagine being Mozart's student. It's terrifying. I mean, he was a fine composer, but Mozart wrote the musical joke based on his exercises, which couldn't have been that comfortable to listen to on the premiere. But here's his notes, and if we look at these, I'll interpret what you see here. He's showing the difference between major semitones and minor semitones. What? The difference between E and F and F flat and F. They're the same on the piano. They're the same on the guitar. What are you talking about? Here's what he was talking about. Let's imagine a series of pure thirds. C to E and E to G sharp, which sound like this. Then if we go up to the C, it's very wide. You hear that? There is a solution. Rather than shifting that G sharp, we can imagine that there is a third coming down from the C to a new note that we'll call A flat, which means G sharp and A flat were not the same. G sharp. What? That means we could split accidentals, which means we could play sonorous triads in different keys. But that would mean having different notes for G sharp and A flat and F sharp and G flat, which seems ridiculous. It means you'd have all instruments and teaching would have to be completely different. Yes, it was. Here's a fingerboard diagram on the left showing the difference between G sharp and A flat. Split key keyboards, which allowed you to play those intervals in different contexts. And a scale. You're expected to practice your scales like this. It would take much longer. We think of microtonal discussions as maybe being experimental or historical or interesting, but microtonality is alive and well, mainly in the Western world through the blues, which just explores this whole gradient in beautiful ways. Here is a recording of Vera Hall. She was a daughter of a freed slave and a wonderful blues folk singer. This is a 1937 recording by Alan Lomax. And you can hear these inflections in her beautiful voice.
Ooh, Lord, ain't my trouble so hard. Ooh, Lord, ain't my trouble so hard. Don't nobody know my trouble but God. Don't nobody know my trouble but God.
And when we examine recordings like this in other seminal blues players, when we have an octave, we don't really have a scale. We have this landscape with clusters and ridges and planes. You'll see that we have roots and octave clusters, but between the minor and the major third, it's just this mountainous region. The minor third is associated with sadness, the major third with joy, but they explore this bittersweet continuum between them. And we can come up with just harmonic close relations, which may be valid, but really a lot of the power comes between teasing between these landing points. We have the same at the flattened fifth and the seventh, and sometimes these are called neutral thirds, neutral fourths and sevenths, not happy or sad, but this blend of bittersweet beauty. Here's an excerpt from the tragically short-lived Stevie Ray Vaughan playing and really teasing out those minor, major, and other bittersweet tones.
Burn. Made my poor heart skip a bee. We
started this lecture talking about Pythagoras and his idea of the music of the spheres and his conception of this ordered universe which played beautiful music. But we now have the tools to know how those planets are rotating and to recreate those frequencies. So using the law of octave equivalence, what I've done for you is taken the planets and just taken them up 36 octaves. So we get a scale that you can hear. What's it going to sound like? I give you the solar scale. Quite neatly, it's two tetrachords separated by the asteroid belt, kind of like those Greek tetrachords. I've had to invent some clefs here, so it's 32 octaves below that note. Now, I've not finessed this for you, which many people do and do these sonifications. They're going to give you the frequencies pure and simple, and it's going to sound not as harmonious as many might think. I happen to love it. But let's hear the solid planets, then the gas planets, and then in one swirl. About music is that we're not just slaves to some mechanisms of there. We can learn to appreciate tones and express ourselves within them. We are free agents, essentially. And so I'm going to let you sit just for 2 minutes with that scale. I'm going to curate to you And you'll hear what I've done is I've put the planets in one by one. And you'll get the rhythm of the planets, which is 20 octaves above their actual spin rate. And then the harmony will emerge. It's 2 minutes and I'll join you at the end. Musicians use the full gradient of pitch to express themselves. Sometimes it's aiming for a harmonic purity, sometimes it's fighting against it. And it's somewhere between this striving for perfection and an embrace of the perfectly imperfect that music and indeed happiness lives. Thank you so much. Thank you. Dominic, thank you so much. Thank you.
I'm afraid you get memails. Hello, everyone. I should say I'm Dominic Broomfield McHugh, visiting professor of music at Gresham, and I was asked to step in an hour ago because the people in charge were so stressed by how complicated and challenging this was going to be, thinking that I would be well placed to deal with it, which is absolutely hilarious from my point of view, because I know nothing about mathematics. Anyway, it is a great honour to lead the Q&A. Thank you so much, Milton, for that. I was so moved by your composition at the end.
Thank you so much.
I'm never going to be able to stand up there and ask any questions. Before we do the Q&A, I wanted to remind everyone that the transcripts of the lectures are available online. And in Milton's cases, there's lots more information available to download, so I really recommend looking at those. Now, another reminder that you can submit questions for this Q&A by using the QR code on the leaflets, which you should have on your chairs. And we do have a few questions, but I think you've already answered some of them. So let's see whether you agree that you've answered them.
Okay.
One of them is, how exactly does a guitar tuned using harmonics which are not tempered play in tune with a piano that is tempered? But you kind of...
Well,
you showed a great solution to that, which is change your piano.
Hang on, so a guitar is... Oh, you mean an untempered... Do they mean an untempered guitar? Because a guitar is generally an even-tempered guitar, which will marry with a even-tempered piano. But the question really is, how do people, let's say a choir, sing to a piano? And what do they do? And is it any different from when they sing a cappella and when they sing with a piano? And you can answer that, perhaps. But when we look at ensembles that are unencumbered by fret and string placements, we find that they do merge towards those harmonic points. Not that they're better, but it seems to resonate. And I've talked to the Swingle singers who I managed to play with once, and they talk about making these little changes from chord to chord, much like the Mozart example, where they tweak a G sharp to an A flat, depending on context. And with the piano, they wouldn't do that so much.
Mozart caused a lot of trouble in his 35 years, did he not?
Yeah.
We have a question from Blake. Is there a relationship between wavelengths of audio and the colours a person with synesthesia might see?
That's a beautiful question.
Yes.
And actually a lecture for an upcoming lecture called
22nd of February.
That we're not next one, but an up one in the future that I hope to do exactly on that thing. Mm-hmm. I'd like to say it'd be nice if it was, but it seems that synesthetes are actually as varied as you can imagine. So I saw this wonderful exhibition where a single note was played to a set of synesthetes, and then they got animators to animate what they were hearing. And you could tell each synesthete apart, and there was no correlation at all. So that's not the case, but it does seem that there's a preference to lower. Reds tend to be lower. So Scriabin, I believe, had reds for his lower notes too, but I do know how octave works. I think it really varies. And what's really sweet is that the seven colours of the rainbow were made because Newton wanted them to be seven notes and, various other reasons. Because, let's face it, indigo violet is a kind of a dodgy area. And before that, there were only three colours. So you could demark it wherever you want to. And it's almost an octave when you look at the visible spectrum. In a later lecture, I'll bring down the light so we can hear that. But it's just short of an octave. So again, it's a strange order if there is order in the cosmos.
Mm-hmm. Super, thank you. How to figure out, it says the plants sounds. I think that means planets, does it? Or plants, well, it could mean either.
Yeah.
And both. It is amazing. Love it. Is it about the speed that they move around?
Okay, so the last example, yeah, it's a bit hard to explain. So imagine that the Earth goes around the sun every year. Well, it's easy to imagine that. And what we do is speed it up. So we make it go twice around, or four, and then 8, 16, 32. And when we do that fast enough, it starts to enter a rhythmic range. If you do it 20 odd times, you start to hear it as dick, dick, dick. And then if you keep going up to octaves, around 31, it'll start ending the pitch spectrum. And then at 36 octaves, it's C sharp 9 sharp.
Of course. Good. No.
Lucky
I got
job.
It, but yeah. To what extent do our modern brains, do we have modern brains?
No, I don't.
Okay, problematize the question. Hear music differently from our Baroque forebears?
Oh, that's great.
Yes, question, tell me about a modern brain.
Well,
or a Baroque
brain. The thing is, there are certain Pandora's boxes we can't close. For example, imagine only hearing music when it's live. It's just a different context and a different experience. How brains have changed for that, it's hard to know. I have a question, which I shouldn't be asking the question, but perfect pitch in that era, was it sort of a localized perfect pitch, or was it less prevalent because people were using different reference points? There was no unified reference point. I imagine it's quite profound, but also the recent years, the musical history is so short and compared to, we've been making music for a long time, but in terms of, music we share in that way and global exchange, it's so recent that I don't think there's been an evolution, but it probably triggers certain built-in aspects of our brains rather than changing them. But I would imagine it's of a huge difference.
Yeah.
And you can't even imagine not hearing an instrument. So, for example, imagine Debussy at the opening of the Eiffel Tower, and what he hears, grown up in Western music and classical music, is a gamelan ensemble. He wouldn't have heard a recording of it. They came over, and he was transfixed, and for hours he would transcribe it and write prose about how hauntingly beautiful, and I don't know if we can recreate those sort of schisms in our experience now.
No, it's really hard to transport ourselves back to a time pre-internet, pre-international travel being as it is now.
Pre-Brexit.
I find it's so stressful, or not stressful, but strange teaching students now who don't remember the pre-internet age, which I do. And I kind of think you can't really imagine what the world was like when we didn't interact with it in that way. So dealing with music back hundreds of years and imagining other brains is, it's pure, it's fiction, isn't it, really? We have to sort of make it up.
Exactly.
Good. Which one is higher, A flat or G sharp, in the Mozart example?
Okay,
so nice, easy one.
Yeah, that's it. Which one is higher is the A flat, which is surprising because we expressive intonation tells us that sharp note should go higher. But what we can think of is the difference between what is a horizontal intonation. Imagine we're getting a leading tone to a note. Sometimes musicians tweak those sharper because we're getting sort of to that note. But as they sit together, G sharp will be lower than A flat, but you can think of it as the letter is lower. So you go G to G sharp and then A flat to A. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about any cases where octaves are not, in capital letters, universally heard and understood?
Yeah, brilliant question. So I said near universal, and there are one culture, which I can't recall right now, where there's a different name at the octave above, but it's so rare that it's practically universal. However, the tuning of octaves is not. Even on pianos, you've heard of stretched octaves, where to make the piano sing, they stretch out the tuning a little bit. It still sounds in tune, but it's tweaked higher. But probably the most interesting example is, in fact, gamelan, where what they're looking for is a sort of bright, shimmering tone, as opposed to notes being in tune in that way, with that fundamental. And because they're metallic, they have all sorts of overringing harmonics that don't quite fit into that system. So it's a more timbral organization in that way. Mm-hmm. And there's one paper that came out which showed that there was a culture where when someone played the music, they played it back in a different key and not at octaves.
When did equal temperament become the norm?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, really, it's when it was pushed through for a couple of reasons. One, the music that was being made where you wanted in late Romanticism, where you enjoyed the fact that A flat could be a G sharp because it made for these magical changes, and also serialism and so on. Of course, computer music, where they treat them as a number, the same number, G sharp and A flat, where they have the same MIDI number. But it's also when music came into the home, and pianos and the simplicity of making them and teaching in that way, it became more communal music making. So it was really the turn, the late 19th century into the 20th century, where, and that's why most people don't even question the piano that they receive.
Yeah, I really question the piano I receive all the time, and this explains why. Final question. Do you think advancements in music production software to make different tuning systems more accessible could change the sound of mainstream music? What does mainstream music mean?
Well, okay, so tuning system more accessible, you mean more prevalent, sort of non-equal temperament, more prevalent. I think it's already doing that. It's done that for rhythm, where this wonky rhythms has become a norm, where the off-grid rhythms have become a norm in electronic music, and now you hear them in adverts and everywhere. But software is actually amazing at doing that. There is a new sort of protocol called MPE and MIDI 2.0, which allows you to, in the past, when you bent a note on the piano, all the notes moved, but now you can bend them individually. And software like Ableton Live 12, now you can change the tuning of the entire system to anything that you invent. And I predict that we will see a resurgence. I mean, it's always been there, but there's an embrace of the microtonal universe.
Super, thank you so much. Can you remind us when your next lecture is and what it's about?
It's February 22nd, am I right, Lucy? I hope that's
the
case.
Sorry, I could look it up.
That was the hardest question of all of those.
Okay. If you look in your leaflet.
And I'll tell you the subject in the meantime. It's on scales and modes, and how we put these notes together to evoke beautiful scales, melodies, and how different cultures around the world create this wonderful palette of colours.
Super, and the tickets should go on sale next week. Well, thank you so much again to everyone for coming along,
thank
everyone
you.
For tuning in online. And can we thank once again Professor Milton Mangini.
Thank you so much. Thank you.